is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What makes a house a home? A place not just to live, but to dwell. Our guest today, historian and author Howard Mansfield, says it's a question that comes up for each generation in America. For himself, Mansfield defines home as where we live, heart and soul. And in his new book, Dwelling and Possibility, Mansfield seeks what he calls the soul of shelter. It's a quality he feels we've largely lost. And so in his book, Mansfield scours history to see how we've achieved this ideal of home in the past. He explores the experience of hearth and how gathering around the fire for warmth drew people together by necessity. Also, what happened when that family fireplace became the furnace in the basement, and how he temporarily returned to that hearth-based lifestyle during the ice storm of 08. Mansfield also describes his modern-day explorations of house and home through a visit to communities still wrecked by Hurricane Katrina and his adventures as a U.S. Census taker in the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, Howard Mansfield is here, and we'll dig into what he means by the soul of shelter. Let's hear from you. How do you define home? Does it have to be where we live, or can we define it more broadly? Have you ever lived in a perfectly nice house that wasn't home? And have longer work hours, telecommuting, or greater technology taken away that sense of what home is? Give us a call, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange at nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Howard Mansfield, it's so great to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's pick up on that part of your book that I just read. In each generation, Howard, you say, we're discussing this, we're debating this, we're thinking about this, what we mean by home.
Yeah, Americans have always had a lot to say about what their neighbors were living in, as well as what they were living. You can look at Walden, you know, by Thoreau is a commentary on that, that it's contemporary with the Beecher sisters wrote about American home domestic science. You take it through the 1920s, you take it through right through today about people commenting on other people living in McMansions and this great desire we all have to run out and buy shelter magazines to see how other people live, or there's TV channels where you watch other people's houses and people always tuning in. So are we living right? Is our neighbors living better? Is there some little something that's going to really make us live right? I mean, do we need the granite countertop and, you know, the fancy appliances of the cathedral ceiling, blah, blah, blah? Is that what's lacking? And of course it isn't, but we're made to feel that it is.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I hear you on, you know, all the magazines and the TV shows and the websites and the comparisons and blah, blah, blah. But we've always been kind of obsessed with how we're living and how our neighbors are living?
Always. And in fact, when we used to have that, you know, when the Tocqueville would come over here and the other English visitors, they would comment on what Americans were living in. And that was one of their commentary. That was one of the things people were most sensitive about, you know. Are we just camping out here, or are we just really living the right way? Are we in the right kind of house? And there's that great parade of house styles in the 19th century where everybody's trying to stay in fashion, live correctly, and there's this whole push for the Christian home. And then there's this whole sense where the house gets cluttered at the end of the 19th century, and then you have the craftsman movement come in and everything's cleared out again. It just goes on and on like that.
Well, and I'll definitely talk to you about the cluttering and the decluttering a little bit later. And it was interesting to me to learn that this isn't the first time we've been in an anti-cluttering era. But the subtitle of the book, Howard, if we could please, The Soul of Shelter. I mean, what is that? And does it vary a lot from person to person?
Yeah, what I was wanting to look at in the book, and it's right there in the title, in Dwelling and Possibility, is that old-fashioned word dwelling. Are we losing track of that? And it's a question of qualities. It's a question of how we are at home. It's a question of, are we happy in our home? Is this enhancing our lives or not? It's not a question of square footage and all that kind of thing. So when you go through the home, what really makes us happy is there room for us to be at peace? Is there room for silence? Is there room for tumult? Is there room for passing the time with friends? Essentially, is there room for ourselves? And what you see in the house today and why there's this discussion about it is essentially between the domestic clutter and the computer and work coming home, we're crowding ourselves out of our own home, and people are going a little crazy that way. those decluttering shows that people watch. One of them, they take an average of like half a ton of trash out a year out of somebody's house. Statistics, 23% of Americans will admit to paying bills late because they just can't find them. And 25% of Americans say they can't park their car in a two-car garage because there's too much junk in it. And when you get down to it, between that and then just work chasing everybody home and all these devices, and when you get down to it, we're completely inverse from where we started at the founding of this country. A house in this part of the country in the early founding would be about 700 square feet, about the size of a two-car garage, and it'd be jammed with people.
About the size of a two-car garage. Wow.
Yeah, and you might have a bowl, a spoon, a chair. That's it. That's what you'd have. And today we live in 10 to 14 times the amount of space. And there's still people, a lot of people, one in 10 American families has to rent storage sheds. There's more storage sheds now than McDonald's, like 51,000 storage sheds around the country. The American Storage Shed Association, whatever the trade group is, says that if every American wanted to shelter under the space in the storage shed, which is a horrifying thought that they could. So what we're getting is too much stuff, not enough life, not enough time for just the ordinary pleasures of passing a day. We're just losing track of the obvious kinds of things, like the hearth, like you mentioned there.
Well, so again, to this the soul of shelter, you know, when you look at the title, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter, it could feel, if you haven't read the book, it could feel like, oh my gosh, here's Howard Mansfield, you know, telling me I need to not only clean up my house, but I need to find soul in my house now, too. You know, now I really feel pressured.
Yeah,
it's not enough to keep it clean. Now I got to find soul, too. I mean, so what are you really trying to get at there, Howard? This isn't a self-help book.
It's not a self-help book. It's not saying you need the perfect kitchen and the perfect porch and all that kind of nonsense. It's like an anti-shelter magazine book in a sense. And I write for some of those shelter magazines sometimes. It's just saying make room for yourself in your house. Make room for your life. If these things are in the way of your life, all this stuff, then clear it out and go on. And just, does it enhance your life? Hang on to it. If not, get rid of it. But it's saying think again about what makes you happy, what makes a place real, what makes a place connected, and try and pay attention to that.
Our phone number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, the guest is New Hampshire author and historian Howard Mansfield. His new book is Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. How do you define the soul of shelter? How do you define home? Does it have to be exactly where we live? Can we define it differently? Also, as Howard has said, how has technology changed the way we look at home? Maybe neither for better nor for worse, just different. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Howard, your first chapter is your impressions on house hunting. And that's where you really start to dig into this idea of what we mean of home. And there's some great descriptions. And I think everybody who's done house hunting can relate to what you've written. You walk in 30 seconds, you know
exactly
whether you like this place or
exactly
not.
We can, you know, when you walk into a place, you're going to buy this place tonight within 30 seconds. You're going to stay longer because you want to be polite to the real estate agent. You're
going to look at all the closets, look at the basement.
Ask about the school district or the neighbors, and you're going to be out of there. But you know, there's a quality that we all respond to. We're very good at recognizing it. We have a hard time often creating it in our homes and in our public places, those kind of welcoming places.
There's a lot of just little bullet notes of your impressions when you and your wife went house hunting. Just share a few of those with us, Howard. It's great.
These are some of the houses that we saw. Houses that smell from the morning's bacon all day long, where one breakfast seems to compound the next, as if staleness were compounded daily like an old-fashioned passbook savings account. Houses that smell of feet or vaguely like diapers, even though the children are in high school. Houses you covet, so airy, so modest in their grandeur. Houses where everything seems to be right. Husband loves wife, cat loves dog, tree loves house loves view. Houses that are worn and comfortable like an old fielder's mitt, like the sweatshirt and jeans the commuting executive wears on Saturdays. Houses that are mysterious in their blandness, the rooms of furniture set out as expected, as prescribed. But you know no one really lives there. Where's the real life? This is a front. You want to see and don't want to see the private rooms. Houses that are walled with photos of children, grandchildren, nieces and grandnieces, the walls of diplomas hanging like battle ribbons. Houses that you pass 100 days, 1,000 days, maybe every day of your life and no one enters. Even the lawn seems to be self-mowing, the mail self-removing. Houses that command a hill, houses that play hide-and-seek behind trees and shrubs.
Again, that's Howard Mansfield reading from his latest book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. By the way, Howard will be speaking and reading from his book this Saturday at the Toadstool Bookshop in Peterborough at 11 in the morning. You can join us now with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. A little bit more, Howard, if you could, please, on this house hunting that you and your wife, Cy Montgomery, went on. Because it's pretty funny. I mean, the two of you kind of walk in and one of you feels one way instinctively and the other feels the other way just as instinctively.
Yeah, well, I really love house hunting because the mystery that I'm interested in is that some houses are home and some aren't. And why is that? So I would just get caught up in the psychological drama of the house and look around. There was a house we were in, and I happened to know this fellow. It had a newborn in the house. You know, he wasn't there then. And we're looking around the house, and it was not any place we were ever going to buy. And we came out, and I said, isn't that odd? Here, this guy has like an infant, a newborn infant, and a wife, and there's only pictures of him in the house. This guy's going to be divorced. I've never seen that. We would see just some terrible houses, and my wife would say, that was awful. And I'd say, yes, but did you see that furnace, that little red furnace from Sweden? You can burn wood, coal, tofu. You could heat the whole house for a winter with a copy of The Shining, you know? I mean, but the house, forget the house. It's just very interesting to go and look in other houses and see how people are living. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be a census taker, just to kind of get in and talk to people and see how things were going. And the census I really wanted to take was, you know, not how many rooms people had and all those questions the census wanted us to ask, which I asked. But I just wanted to say, well, so how's it really going with you? How's it going with your soul? Are you happy here?
Did you ever ask people that?
Not directly, but
you're not supposed to. You're an official U.S. Census taker.
And I didn't ask any questions I wasn't supposed to. But, you know, people come forward and they start talking, and I'm not going to stop them. And I had a lot of interesting conversations with people. They would tell you that history of the house, all sorts of things like that. What was wrong with the country?
We'll hear more about that coming up after a super short break. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And don't want to fix the latest thing to break down on your vehicle? Well, maybe it's time for you to donate it to NHPR. It's as easy as becoming a member. All you have to do is make a phone call. We'll fill out the paperwork and arrange for the pickup and sale of your vehicle. Call 1-877-393-NHPR to get things started or go to nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Dana-Farber New Hampshire Oncology, Hematology, and Londonderry, offering consultations with disease specialists from Dana-Farber in Boston, danafarber.org/Londonderry. And the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, everything made from organic and sustainable materials, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. New Hampshire weather is sunny today, highs mid-70s to around 80. Clear tonight, low temperatures in the 40s. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs from mid-70s to around 80 degrees. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the concept of home and the connections we have to our houses, our sense of dwelling in the places where we live. Our guest is Howard Mansfield, noted New Hampshire author and historian. His new book is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. How do you define home? Does it have to be where you live, or could you define it more broadly? How have longer work hours, telecommuting, or expanded technology taken away some of the sense of what home is? Or has it just changed, neither better or worse, just different? Also, have you ever lived in a perfectly nice house that somehow wasn't home? We'd love to hear from you this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Howard, let's go to our listeners now. And Karen's calling from North Conway. Hi, Karen. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I lived in another section of New Hampshire for 27 years in a big old Victorian farmhouse and really loved it. But due to well, due to terrible circumstances, I found myself in that home by myself. I lost my husband to cancer. My daughter had moved, graduated from college, and, you know, starting a life of her own. And here I was in this big old house. So I said, well, you know, it's just a house. You know, the home part is going to go with me. And I sold it, and I sold just about everything that I owned.
Wow.
I moved out of town, but then I moved back because I missed the area so much. But I moved into a little house, and I went from an 8-room house to a 3-room house. Every once in a while, I come across something, I say, oh, man, I can't believe I sold that. I wish I had it back. But not too often. But the big thing about my story is my old house is back on the market. And I really thought long and hard about moving back to my old house. And then I really realized...
You can't go home again.
The building was not what made it home.
Mm, you
know, I brought with me my home. So it was just, you know, when you talk about people having stuff, I still have too much stuff for a three-room house, but I have everything I need.
Wow, Karen, first of all, my sympathies about your husband. Second of all, what a great story. And Howard, what do you think?
I think Karen raises an interesting point about housing, that it has to be flexible and it has to change over time.
It's not just the place.
And when you look at the old houses in New England, they have done that in the past. You look at some of these big houses with the L's on it. At one point, they have one family, then they become two family houses, and then they will return again to one family houses. If you look at main streets of most towns, you'll see very big houses next to very small houses, and you'll see people moving as their life changes from a big house and their family goes on to a small house. And it's that kind of flexibility that's missing in suburban subdivisions, where everything is the same exact footage. So it's good that you found that flexibility and that courage to move on.
Yeah, well, I wonder, you know, so much, and she's so right, so much of how we feel about home has to do with the people, you know, the people we've shared it with or that we currently share it with. What are your thoughts there, Howard? And what do you do if the house isn't the problem, but there's conflict in the family or, in Karen's case, you know, too many sad memories? I mean, all of a sudden that wonderful home is no longer a home.
Yeah, boy, I don't, it's, it, you know, I guess when I was doing the census and I was looking around at houses, I saw that the best houses and the places that were happiest were almost recreated every day by what people did there. It's almost as if the people and the house were breathing at the same rate. That's sort of what I saw when I was looking around.
Now, what do you mean by that, where it's in the everyday?
Yeah, when we're really happy, we're connected to our jobs, to our family, to our lives, to the outside. And when there's a lot of unhappiness, part of that has to do with disconnection. And you see that in places, and you can sense this in places. And certain houses are just set up to further bring that out and not get you out of that track. It's almost as if you have a bad thought or a bad emotion, and you just get in those loops where it keeps coming up. And bad houses and bad places are like loops that keep bringing up bad behavior and bad thoughts. Public places, too. You see that all the time.
Karen, thanks a lot for that call. Great story. And Ken is next from Antrim. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. One of my favorite movies was called Buckaroo Banzai. And in that movie, there's a great line. It's I want to go home. Home is where you hang your hat. And it just really resonated with me because it's a place where you feel safe and secure and you can be yourself. And that's the most important thing that I can think of.
And are you feeling good about where you live, Ken? You're feeling like home really is a place where you can hang your hat?
Yes, I do. But the only problem is I'm disabled and I'm behind in my town taxes, state taxes. So that is the only negative I can say. But other than that, I love my home. And it is, I have two cats and a dog. And it is my home.
Ken, thanks a lot for calling in. And boy, home is where you can hang your hat. That's a favorite line, I think, Howard, for a lot of people. You know, he talked about, he didn't say it directly, but, you know, the fear that you might lose your home. You know, you owe some taxes and so forth. That's a chunk of this book, too, isn't it, Howard? You go down to the Gulf Coast. You talk to people who lost their homes from Hurricane Katrina. It's pretty devastating. It's more than just a place that you lost that you have to rebuild.
Yeah, I went and visited Andy Card from Peterborough, who's a professional photographer who went down first with the Red Cross in the in immediate aftermath of the storm. And then she stayed on in this city called, beguiling place called Pascagoula, Mississippi, and started her own immediate direct relief effort to help people rebuild homes in this little poor neighborhood. And what you felt when I went down there, it was already 18 months after the storm, and it was still so much devastation. People would ask me, well, how is it down there? And I would say, it's not as bad as you think. It's a lot worse.
Wow.
Imagine if you lost your house, lost your job, and maybe you had some illness, and then everyone around you had, so you lost your community. Or imagine your house survived, but all of a sudden you've got to put up your entire family there. And people, there's a lot of people felt like they had failed their family, they had failed somebody because they couldn't do it. So what you have everywhere is a pervasive sense of everybody trying to go home, but their home was like no place they could recognize anymore because of the storm. And it's what people want in a shelter. People go by their house if it was blown away by the hurricane or washed away. This particular city, the waves came in and covered 90% of the city. It was incredible.
It was in Mississippi.
Mississippi. And people will go. They're looking for photographs. They're looking for that thing their aunt gave them. They're looking for those little landmarks of home, those little things that are every day. It's very hard to pick up after a disaster. And as hard as it is, we don't really appreciate it. We kind of pretty much want to write a check or help people out, and then we expect them to move on, and we move on. But it takes years.
Yeah, two of the things that struck me from that chapter on Hurricane Katrina. One is there was, again, this neighborhood where it basically been leveled. Everything was pretty much gone except, you know, some bricks and some foundations and maybe some stairs. And there was a guy, Howard, whose house was completely gone, and he still came every day to mow the lawn.
Yes, and what Annie Carter, or Miss Annie, as she'd be called down there, and you'd be Miss Laura if you were down there. Miss Annie said, you know, when I first got here, I thought, that was just nuts. What are you doing now when everything needs doing? But you do what you need to do to put your life back together, and you just have to give people room to do that. That was his way of imposing some order, his way of saying, okay, this part is going to be normal. The other thing Miss Annie told me is that you don't really know who's suffering after a storm just by looking at them. You see people out and they're dressed okay and they're outside of their houses okay, but the inside could be gutted. That could be their only set of clothes. So you've got to really listen to people and really be receptive to people to understand the damage and the toll it takes when you're just dispossessed of your house and your home.
And that word just, you know, you know, we hear that so many people died in a terrible storm and so many other people lost their homes. And we think, well, at least the people who, you know, just lost their homes didn't die. And certainly, you know, that is the worst of outcomes. But your chapter made me appreciate just how devastating it is for these folks. All the stresses and strains that you mentioned, Howard, and relationships. I mean, relationships break up because of this.
Do you stay?
Marriages break up.
Yeah, do you stay and take whatever money you got from the insurance company and rebuild, or do you go? Do you get a new life?
Get out of here, right.
Yeah, and people feel differently about that. Do you put up, how long is your crazy cousin going to be in the darn house? You can't kick them out. That puts a pressure on your marriage. All those kinds of things. The thing about these storms is we first perceive them as being vast, and they are. Those huge pictures on the weather map, the trees bending the wind, but they're also intimate. I mean, we were looking at the ruins of one of these houses, and here's one teacup that survived this tremendous storm, and here's another one that's smashed. It's personal, and that's another thing we need to know.
I want to ask you about your chapter, Howard, early in the book, about the New England phenomenon, especially, of the hearth. And, you know, certainly everybody says hearth and home. You write that by necessity, we used to gather together in large families, in large numbers, by the hearth, because the rest of the house was freezing. How did that affect family dynamics?
This is what happened. It's pretty fascinating. And if you want to get at the biggest change in how we live, it's very obvious. But for thousands of years, we lived around a campfire. It's obviously.
We needed light. We needed heat.
That's it.
End of story.
And then when we moved inside, they moved the fire inside. At first, it was an open campfire in a big hall. Then it was under a hood. And then the fireplace developed. Then it was a huge fireplace. Then it was a small fireplace. Then the fire got put into a box. And then the box, the wood stove, essentially went to the basement. No more hearth all of a sudden. And the house is decentralized. What happens is it's centrifugal. Everybody used to be in one room. and you know, maybe mom is sewing and dad is fixing a tool and the kids are figuring, you know, doing their homework kind of thing. Maybe if it's a happy family, they're doing sing-alongs. Sometimes it's a little claustrophobic, but sometimes it's kind of wonderful, this storytelling. And that's gone. And once the house is freed from the hearth, it's completely unmoored. Everybody can go to their own room, that kind of thing. It's a big change.
Well, let's have you read a little bit more from the book on that idea that electricity is now the hearth and we don't have to gather.
Think of the hearth-centered home as a centripetal force pulling everyone to the center. But electricity is centrifugal, throwing everything outward, decentering life. This interior migration is repeated later in the 20th century. The family gathered around the radio for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fireside chats. The family and neighbors crowded around the first television watching Milton Berle. And then everyone dispersed to a private electronic utopia with television, computers, and cell phones in almost every room. Indeed, we now see the same dispersion in the car that we saw in the house. Now kids are hooked to their video IV drip. A video screen drops down or is strapped to the back of a seat, or an iPod is piped into the ears. The happy family, alone, together. Or is that together alone? But first the fire goes out of the hearth. None of this would happen without losing the fire. A home without a hearth was unmoored. It was a tent without its central pole removed. Once the hearth is extinguished, just what is a home? The Beechers in the 19th century and many others were campaigning to bring order to the post-hearth home. They were struggling to redefine a place once defined by the hearth.
Wow. In the car, we used to, you know, there's the image of the family singing songs or talking or playing license plate games. And then you write the video IV drip. Ouch.
Well, you see it all the time. I mean, you know, there's a great value in boredom or annoying your brother and those car trips. But now people feel they have to occupy every single moment of their time, of their house. Everybody has this notion to have to fill everything in. And that's what's driving people a little crazy. You need boredom. You need quiet spaces. You need spaces for daydreaming. There was in the book, I talk about Gaston Bachelard, a great French writer and a beloved figure in France, who wrote this wonderful book called The Poetic of Space. And he says, a great house, a good house is a place for daydreaming, for reverie. It frees you to get in touch with your imagination. It frees you to go forth in the world. And we're not leaving room for that in our houses. We're not leaving room for the nothing much that is home, for just the ordinary moments. Everything doesn't have to be scheduled. Everything doesn't have to be filled with tweets and texts and videos and emails. There should be room.
So we're stuffing our houses full of stuff, if I can put it that way, and we're stuffing our time full of other stuff.
And losing life. Yes.
You know, when the family, the home moved away from this hearth-centered home and the furnace moved down to the basement, talk a little bit more about that because there was this backlash, right? I mean, Harriet Beecher Stowe and her sister, Catherine, I believe it was, said, no, 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 this is terrible for America. So it was an instance where technology kind of caused a social movement, and then that social movement created a temporary backlash.
Yeah, the American Woman's Home by the Beecher Sisters is full of these great rhapsodic passages about the open fire. And at one point they say, you know, Washington and his men didn't freeze at Valley Forge so we could have our fires and wood stove boxes and other things. They believed in the open hearth. You know, but then
they lost the battle, though, didn't they?
They lost the battle, and some of the women who had cooked over those stoves and kept those fires going in those big hearths said, "Are you kidding? I love my wood stove. I love coal. You keep your hearth. That's you're being poetic about it, but you weren't the one, you know, over that stove or that fire 8-10 hours a day,
yeah,
keeping it up."
And that's what I appreciate about the book too. You know, you let the Beecher Stowe women have their say,
yes,
but then you keep it real. You say, wait a minute, you know, things would burn. People were, you know, their faces would burn on the front. Their rear ends were freezing.
The number of children who fell into those huge fireplaces is huge, and the number of fires that children lost to fire. And if you go through any town history, you'll see the number of houses lost to fire. It's constant. The hearth is a mercurial god. It really took a lot of people away.
Easy to get romantic about it.
At this distance, yes.
Let's take another call. And this is Judith waiting in your hometown, Hancock. Hi, Judith. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for calling me. I just want to say that I am loving this book, and I really hope everyone with a dwelling or a hope for a dwelling will read it. But Howard, you say in your early chapters that you'd love to go cross-country, knocking on everybody's door and asking if you could come in and looking around. And you'd like to ask people, what's your favorite room and what's your latest home improvement? So I wondered, as you did your research, which favorite rooms over time or over history or contemporary that you encountered that you enjoyed seeing? And if you care to say, in your own dwelling, what's your favorite room?
Well, and Judah, thanks for the call. And it's interesting, too, you talk about in the book, you know, everybody still has a kitchen, obviously, and everybody still has bedrooms. But other rooms have changed, you know, the parlor, the family room, the dining room. You know, this idea of rooms has changed.
Yeah, and you know, if you look, traditionally we were talking about criticism of home. Everybody feels they have to have a very formal room for guests, which would have been the front parlor, which persists today in the living room. And yet, and then there's the room where everybody lives, which is usually the kitchen. And that goes on. You know, you've got your front door, but everybody comes in the back door, the side door, that kind of thing. Some of the – in our house, I guess, one of my favorite rooms is actually outside. It's – the barn used to be attached to the house sometime in the 1920s. I think it was dragged off. Very common history. But it left in the foundation this sheltered area we call a grotto, and this – there's this huge old silver maple that shelters it, and then the house is alongside. It forms an outside room, and we sit there in the summer, have guests over, eat out there, and we have a view. We have a few acres and a pasture, and it's just idyllic. And when our neighbor's horses are in the field, it's just beautiful. I mean, horses are beautiful. Not owning them is even more beautiful. So that's one of my favorite places. And in houses I've seen, my favorite kind of houses are the houses that are adapted over time. And one room might be 1840, and the kitchen might have been done in 1950, and the bathroom might be 1990. And people are comfortable there. And it all kind of works. Those are my favorite kind of places. My other favorite kind of places are often not the house themselves, but sheds, the sheds that are attached to them, the barns.
You've got a whole almost chapter on sheds.
Yeah, I love sheds. My favorite... In our town of Hancock, on our main street, one of my favorite buildings is a horse shed. There are these beautiful curved horse sheds behind. It's a great piece of work behind the meeting house. But what's great about sheds is, and the lesson we can take from them, is that they're adaptable. They're loose. Life flows through them. You can change them and change them again. And essentially, they're the same, but they're there for your generation, and they'll be there for the next generation. It's a great lesson. They're not the highly designed art object that we often see in magazines or by the big deal architect often. They're shambling. They're loose. They're very plain, or one generation are plain, then they get dolled up, and then they get plain again. But they allow life to continue through them.
All right, Judith, thanks a lot for that call. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new questions about background checks and security clearances. Then Margaret Atwood on her latest novel, all coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Ultimate Biz NH Bash, recognizing private companies, family-owned businesses, and women-led businesses, September 30th at Capital Center for the Arts. Details at eventsnh.com. And from Republic, New Hampshire's original certified local farm-to-table restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, Elm Street, Manchester, online at republiccafe.com. Sunny day across New Hampshire, high temperatures mid-70s to around 80, clear tonight, lows in the 40s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with New Hampshire author and historian Howard Mansfield. His newest book is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. By the way, Howard will be speaking and reading from his book this Saturday at the Toadstool Bookshop in Peterborough at 11 o'clock. This hour, we're exploring some of the themes in the book, including how we define home, and we'd love to hear from you on that. Does it have to necessarily be where we live? Do our possessions or our people help define home? Have you ever lived in a very nice house that somehow was not home to you? Also, how have changing lifestyles affected our concepts of home? Longer work hours, telecommuting, expanded technology. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Howard, just before the break, Judith, our caller, asked you about some of your favorite rooms and so forth, and you talked about that. But she also enjoyed what you say early in the book. You wish you could go to every house in America and say, how's it going? How do you like it? What are your projects? What do you not like about it? You kind of got a little bit of a chance to do that when you were a U.S. Census taker. Tell us what inspired you, first of all, to take on this job of doing the census. It's not easy knocking on people's doors and saying, excuse me, I'm from the government.
Nor is it easy to fill out all the paperwork they want you to fill out. I felt like I was taking the SAT test every day sitting in my truck with all these forms filled out. I want to just go poke around and ask people about their houses. Obviously, I wouldn't ask directly. I only ask the questions I was supposed to go ask. But people want to talk, you know, even the people who at first wanted to be hostile. Like, I can just about get anybody to talk, really. And they would tell me about their house, how they came and bought it, how they grew up there, how their, you know, their spouse had recently died, or how their business had turned down and not doing well, and they might have to sell it. And they would, or they would show me an addition they wanted to do, or just
so. Sometimes people would invite you in.
Mostly, yeah.
Often, really?
Often they were very, you know, New Hampshire people are very friendly, basically. Even though they want to be, everybody was kind of geared up to be hostile. And I went to a lot of places that, you know, don't trespass. This means you don't tread on me flags. Even those people would start talking to me, you know. Even if, you know, I my census basically devolved into a number of different censuses. There was the grumpy old man census. There was the junk truck census. There was the census of angry young men. But the census that really intrigued me was I would go to these in one part, and this is the winter, and I'm in snowshoes and gaiters and going around to these.
Wow, just to do the census, snowshoes and gaiters?
Yeah, well, some of these places were particularly this place, this was a community of summer houses and cabins that were built around the turn of the century. And they were now just sitting there quietly in the snow, and they had this arresting grace because they still had their summer poise. They still were chairs, these little wicker chairs that, on these worn porches were gathered together, still in conversation. The bug spray was still out. The little Japanese paper lanterns were still sitting there. And these places had kind of settled down to earth a little bit and had beguiling views of the lake. It was just entrancing.
But no one was there.
No one was there. And they had this kind of grace that troubled me, because why would these places have so much beauty and grace about it and so many everyday homes, daily homes, places we don't? And was it because this is somebody's idea of New England, somebody's pet house? Or is it because these houses have been curated in such a way that preserve this great feeling of prospect and repose, this great feeling
of... Well, and sometimes the noise and bustle of daily life can take away that, you know,
exactly,
that grace,
exactly,
if you
exactly
want to put
true.
It that way.
This is a place where people could linger.
Well, you learned a lot from the census, and you write about it in the book, and there's a lot of funny stuff in there, like you said, the old man census and the junk census. Read a little bit more from the book, Howard, if you could, please, about what you learned as a U.S. census taker about home and the soul of shelter.
What I learned from my many censuses is that all houses are provisional. No matter how much brick, stone, and wood we erect, no matter how much family history we wrap ourselves in, a dwelling is a temporary encampment. The houses that seem the least temporary are the ones that are settled each day, in which each activity binds the people to the place, planting or building or being in a way so that the house, land, and people seem to be breathing at the same rate. But if we're not here, then our homes are not here. The old farmhouses surely were here. They had no choice. And it's that here-ness that is pleasing. But these days, it seems, we are running short of here. We have a heap of now, but it's a placeless now. Old houses are brimming cups of here. As I walked around, I came to wonder about the possibility of dwelling in the ordinary. What would it take? Why is it that the ordinary is so hard for us? Not the 9-to-5 daily slog, but the grace of the ordinary. The world is a cup running over with grace, and we walk about parched.
I love the concept of the ordinary, Howard. I guess, especially since when I see magazines like Better Homes and Gardens and so forth, I kind of feel pressured, you know, not to be ordinary. So I really appreciate
you
saying that.
Those magazines want you to have the perfect kitchen,
yeah,
the perfect porch, the perfect guest room, the perfect house. And it's essentially a come on, because once you do that, then you're going to have to push on to the next mountain pass and the next mountain pass. And you know what? You're going to be happy in the pretty good kitchen. You're going to be happy on the pretty good porch or deck. You're going to be happy even in the so-so living room. You'll be happy. It's going to be fine. And you know, if you're there having a beer or some wine with friends or your neighbor, you're fine. You're passing. It's about life. It's not about stuff. And it sounds so obvious when you say that, but we kind of just need to exhale a little bit. We all don't have to live the perfect lives. You don't have to get the perfect pictures up on Facebook of the perfect vacation and get the perfect tweet out there. And, you know, it's okay.
I appreciate the so-so living room. I've got a couch that really is just so-so. And every time I walk by, I think, oh, I should fix that.
But it's comfortable.
I haven't. And so, you know, now maybe I'm just not going to bother. It's fine.
You know, Christopher Alexander, architect, author of A Pattern Language, a wonderful set of books which a lot of people love, and I do too, said we love places that are comfortable, ordinary, and profound. And that's exactly it. And sometimes it doesn't photograph well, but it's awfully good to live in.
Let's take another call. And Lucy's waiting in Ashland. Hi, Lucy. Thanks for hanging on. You're on with Howard Mansfield. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. I just want to comment on the heart-centered home, actually. That description was one that was very familiar to me. I grew up in an old farmhouse. It was very large, very drafty. We had two furnaces. But being a fairly low-income family, I think we ended up, setting the furnaces at about 62 and just cranking the wood stove after dinner. And we were all sitting there in the living room, you know. The TV was pretty much always on, and somebody was on the computer, somebody was doing homework, but we were together. And I think I could have named a lot of other homes, you know, growing up in New Hampshire that did still heat with wood stoves and still had just one or two rooms in the house that were warm. So
yeah, no, were you the one, Lucy, that had to fill the wood stove every morning at 5 o'clock when it was freezing?
We did use the furnaces in the morning. after dinner, we'd crank it up and we heated bedstones and took them to bed, and it was really fantastic.
Okay. Lucy, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Howard? Quick thoughts
so,
there.
Obviously, good memories there. You know, mostly good memories. And again, it's the way everybody is together. There's one survey I read by an academic. It said the average amount of time parents and children are in conversation during a day is 14.5 minutes.
Wow, that's not very much.
It's not, but I guess if you have a teenager, that'd be like an epic discussion.
Lucy, thanks a lot for the call. Here's an email from Tom in Portsmouth, and this is interesting. Thanks, Tom, for the email. He says, would you please ask your guest to comment on his perspective on the future of multi-generational housing that will likely develop in the future for economic and demographic reasons? Even though our families are not as nuclear as they once were, there will likely be multi-generational living in the future, much like the early 1900s through the 1940s. How does he see it emerging? Tom, you're right. There's a lot of conversation about this now.
It's exactly what Tom just said. We're coming back to kind of full circle to where we were in the 19th century. There were a lot of different generations in the family living in a house or living next door in a house or in different parts of the house.
Millennials coming home to live with their parents.
That kind of thing. Long-term care for aging parents.
Senior citizens living with their adult children.
And you can see that happening. And what happened is sort of in the prosperity of the post-war years, we got into this very big age segregation thing with the different housing, and we're getting away from that.
Yeah, there's another trend, too. You know, we talked about McMansions in the 90s and so forth, and you talked about that in your book, too, Howard, but I've heard more lately about micro houses, and I think there's even a magazine devoted to, you know, I'm probably not using the right term, but very small houses.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, since housing has gotten so expensive, if you have less, it costs less. It makes sense. You know, if you live more in your community or in your city and less in your house, it's a great approach that way.
Tom, thanks for the email. And you can email us to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's another comment, Randy, from our Facebook page. And thank you, Randy. In 89, our young family was moving quickly to purchase and sale a tract house in Litchfield. Then we found this house in Amherst that violated everything on our priority list. Electric versus gas, private septic field, well versus public water, small kitchen, fewer rooms, etc. But it sat on an elevated hill in Amherst, and its window decks integrated magically into the woods, a home for all seasons. That was 24 years ago. In the interim, we converted, expanded, restored it. Now, with our daughters into their own lives, taking great memories with them, we are left now with a difficult decision of moving away from a very giving friend. Houses are investments, homes are life. Wow, Randy, that's poetic. It's wonderful. Thank you so much
that's
for
really
that.
Well
Howard,
said.
What do you think?
I think that's really well said. They went out with the typical list that everybody, the things you think are important turn out to be not perhaps not important or as important, and they found a place that they could just live and move with. It was flexible. They found the soul of that particular shelter.
It's a gut feeling too that people have.
You pretty much start out how something with your head. You make a list how much money can you have? Where's the school district? But it's a question of the heart or the gut when you decide. That's what it is. You decide that way if you're going to be happy.
It's also interesting. He did what so many New Englanders do. What you mentioned earlier, Howard. You know, over the years, he said we altered it, changed it, and so forth. If you do too much of that, do you hurt the soul of the shelter? I mean,
it depends on the house. You know, there's two really bad things to do to a house. One is nothing, and then the roof goes and the sills go. And the other thing is just too much, and then the house is just buried under stuff. It depends. It depends on the house. It depends on why people are doing it. We have not done much to our house other than, you know, the needed things that you have to do. But we have not blown out walls and all sorts of stuff.
Some people love to do that.
Oh, some people are restless pioneers that way, and they're very good at it. But I think a lot of people might be happier if they just put the reciprocating saw away for a year, you know, and didn't just knock everything out. Just lived in the house for a year and see, what's this like in the morning? What's this like in the winter? What's this like in the summer? Where are we really going to live in these rooms? Where's the light coming from at 5 a.m. or in a winter's evening? You know, what feels warm about the house? What doesn't work? Or what can we work around? I find that eventually old houses make you adapt to them. And you accept the window that sticks this particular way. And you accept the closets that are longer going back than wider, you know, that kind of thing. And you come to appreciate them for those qualities. But then in the meantime, there's all these other qualities that you didn't quite realize that you can't tell by a walkthrough. You know, the way, the light at the end of the day hits the irregular walls, the old plaster walls, if it's an old house, that kind of thing. You just got to give yourself time to live. Let yourself be in the house a little bit.
Let's take another call if we could, Howard. This is Alice waiting in Elliott, Maine. Hi, Alice. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My partner is somebody who is a collector. He collects mostly books, a lot of things, but he likes his stuff. And many years ago, his apartment burned down and he lost everything.
Wow.
And, you know, fortunately got himself and his young daughter out. But people came to his aid by offering him not only stuff, you know, clothes, a place to stay, a room to stay in. Years later, just last year, he ended up in another situation where he moved and left all his stuff behind and never got it back. And again, nowhere to go and no stuff. And people who love him gave him a place to stay. And he's very good at collecting stuff again, but he's learned through both of those experiences that it's the stuff will come and go. And he can make a home in one room. Wherever he is. So he's not by choice, but a little bit, you know, nomadic in the past several years. And so I would say that's taught me, who's lived in a house for the last 10 years with a family, that it's not about the structure necessarily, but the people that are around you that.
You know,
and
Alice,
what
this
you
is a.
With that.
Yeah, and this is a great point. And boy, Howard, you know, if you had the time and the money, it would have been an interesting chapter in this book to look at nomads and how they feel about homes. I love Alice's story. Thank you, Alice.
You're right. It would have been. I'm still just thinking of the story of this poor fellow. It's funny, just a tremendous drama that some people have in their lives that way and other people don't. But the great lesson and the great strength that he took from that. And I thought she was going to say he had too much stuff and he was driving her crazy, but that wasn't where she was going. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. Alice, thanks a lot for calling in. You know, Howard, you're known as a historian, but largely a New England historian. I wonder, do people in other parts of the country care as much about the soul of dwelling, you know, feeling of a house? Do you think so? I mean, even in Las Vegas, do they really care about this stuff in a house that was built, you know, 5 years ago?
Las Vegas.
Maybe that was a bad example.
Well, you know, certainly in the South, they have strong feelings about homes and what they think houses should look like. In the Pacific Northwest and California, they're totally house crazy. particularly in Los Angeles and San Francisco down the other way. So yeah, there's that feeling. It's definitely universal. Some of the most interesting ideas in this country right now have come from California and have come back east. If you look at Christopher Alexander's pattern language, where he says it's a series of patterns that we respond to, and that you can learn this language and you can learn ways to create in your dwelling and in your houses good spaces.
Can a brand new spanking house just opened up yesterday, can that house have soul? I know you're biased towards old houses, but
I am biased.
A lot of them are new, so let's be fair.
That's why I'm hesitating to answer. I'm sure it can. I've seen just great, pleasing spaces that have the things you gravitate towards, light, you know, a certain amount of room, and that feeling of possibility, that feeling that you could be a better person in this house and that you will do the things you've promised yourself that you will do once you move into this house. And that's what we look for when we're house hunting. We're hunting for a place where we'll be a better person. We'll realize our personal manifest destiny. You know, we'll improve, we'll expand, we'll fulfill our lives, or whatever it is that we think we haven't done. We think we're going to do it if we move. And that's one of the reasons why people move again and again. And it's one of the reasons why people who build their own houses never finish them, because they're starting to get near the end and they realize they're not going to get there.
That's very American, isn't it?
It's completely
American.
Constant
drive for self-improvement reflected in our houses.
It's what the Tocqueville said, you build your house to retire in and you sell it before it's done.
Howard Mansfield, so fun to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Laura. I really enjoyed being here.
Howard Mansfield, noted New Hampshire author. His latest book is Dwelling in Possibility. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer, Dan Colgan. Producers, Ellen Grimm, Faith Mikesell. Our volunteers are John Barrett and Alan Cohen. The executive director is Keith Shields. I'm Laura Kanoi.
Even when there's nothing there but gloom, but a room is not a house, and a house is not a home when the two are far apart, and one of us has a broken heart.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. State senators grill Anthem officials as the state's biggest insurer rolls out its new health insurance exchange product. New census numbers show New Hampshire has the nation's lowest poverty rate at 8.1%, and the Granite State joins the Bay State in a lawsuit over new federal fishing regulations. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Lewis Carno and Company Public Relations, supporting the Concord Community Music School in their fall classes, lessons, and programs. Information at ccmusicschool.org. And the law firm of Raff Young and Pignatelli, serving the business and nonprofit community, national impact, uniquely New Hampshire, on the web at rafflaw.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. After the shooting spree at Washington's Navy Yard, President Obama ordered a review of security clearance policies across the government. Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Hagel reiterated the president's directive for a broad review. Hagel said, in